December 4th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN for people who can handle the truth. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1 at yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna at spingola.com, but I do not access that email account during the program. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take your calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Jonathan Gray. He is the author of Forbidden Secret and Dead Men's Secret. His website is beforeus.com. And I was watching a video this morning. Let me see. The name of that video was, well, I don't have it here in my notes, but it was absolutely wonderful. Talked about an underwater bridge in Mount Sinai, and I will dig up the name of that video. I do have it linked on today's date so that you may watch it also. It's just one part of five. Very, very, very interesting. All right. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Yes, and I recognize that wonderful voice of yours from the video.
Well,
I thought, oh, what a pleasant accent. I just love that.
Well, it comes from the other side of the world, actually, a mixture of Australian and New Zealand.
Right, and you're in New Zealand as we speak.
That is correct, yes. We're just entering into summer here.
Right, and it is quite early in the morning, and I so appreciate you getting up. You're, I think, 19 hours ahead of us. And so it's actually the 5th where you are, and it's very early in the morning, correct?
Yes, 2 minutes past 6, Deanna.
Okay, well, I hope that you're an early riser.
Yes, I usually get up early.
Oh, good, good. Well, you have a delightful website. Your books are wonderful, and I hope that that you can share some of these wonderful things that, I've been reading about and looking at. And I was just amazed that in the video that I watched this morning about this this underwater bridge, this section of land, and how you explained how the wind can create ice from water and all the other biblical kinds of things that you shared in this five-part video.
Oh, yes, that's been one of our most exciting finds, has been the remains spread out across the floor of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aqaba branch of the Red Sea between the Sinai Peninsula and Saudi Arabia.
Right, and the fact that for all of these centuries, Mount Sinai is actually not in the right place. I mean, it was just a mountain that they decided, oh, this is the mountain. This is what we'll describe as Mount Sinai, when in fact it was over in Midian, totally in a different place. So
yes, that's correct. Yes, and all the evidence is over there. Of course, there's no evidence for the traditional site whatsoever,
which is amazing. But I have never really known anybody that has described some of the artifacts and some of the evidence that that supports the Bible, and I believe you're the first one that I'm aware of that has done this, and as I said, very, very interesting. All right, we do have to take a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors with our guest today, Jonathan Gray. Stay tuned. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Jonathan Gray, the author of Forbidden Secret and Dead Men's Secrets. And you can get both of those books. Well, you can get the one, Forbidden Secret, at the website beforeus.com. And I believe you can also purchase it through Amazon. You can get a Kindle version of Dead Men's Secrets, and you can also get the hard copy and a paperback. And that looks like a very, very fascinating book, and I'm a big user of the Kindle version of things. And the name of that, the video that I was talking about is Surprising Discoveries, and the sea will tell. So I don't know where you'd like to start, so I'm just going to let you take it away and just start educating us about the things that you've discovered.
Well, Deanna, you perhaps wanted to talk a little bit about that Red Sea crossing discoveries. That's one of our most interesting ones.
Oh, I think so. And all the artifacts that you found under the sea is just amazing. Chariot wheels and horses' hooves and everything.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, the traditional site of, if you look at the maps that we are given, and even maps in the backs of Bibles, you'll find that these are largely guesswork based upon the knowledge that was available at the time they were first drawn up. And it's traditionally been thought that the exodus from Egypt was either a myth, or else if it was true, then they crossed over the Red Sea near the Gulf of Suez, near the Suez Canal somewhere in the Gulf of Suez, and then they went straight up to the land of Canaan, Israel, from there. Now, the truth is that the record, the old record in Exodus and through the Old Testament, is that it was deep sea, it wasn't shallow. And I guess the reason why a lot of people have thought it might have been the Gulf of Suez area is because the Gulf of Suez is very shallow. But when they came to the sea, the Exodus record says that they were still within Egyptian territory. Now, if you go down from Cairo in Egypt and you cross the sea, and you're well, the whole thing is that the topography is not the same. It says when you get down to the Red Sea, you are hemmed in. You're hemmed in by mountains. That's in the book of Exodus. You're shut in. Now, Egypt, if you go down toward the Gulf of Suez, it's all open country. It's all flat land. There are some hills in the distance, but you're not shut in. So we looked for, first of all, a place where they could get out of Egypt, out of Egypt proper, and then be shut in before they came to the Red Sea. And other than going back backwards, if you cross the traditional route and then keep on going southeast, you come to a canyon. The canyon's about 27 miles long. It winds and twists like a snake. You're really shut in, and it ends at the Red Sea. Now, the Red Sea has two branches. It doesn't just have the Gulf of Suez. It has the Gulf of Aqaba. And when we read Josephus, the Jewish historian, we find that he says that when they got to the Red Sea, they were shut in by mountains on the south and on the north as well. So you come out of a canyon. You have mountains on the north of you, you have mountains on the south of you, you have the sea in front of you to facing east. There's no other way you go except straight into the sea. That's very different from what the topography of the Suez Canal area is, which is very, very flat.
Right.
So that's kind of the setting.
In your video, you show these mountains, and it's a very visual, wonderful presentation. And you compare what it says in the scripture to the mountain and demonstrate exactly what the truth is or exactly what the scripture says. And like I said, something I've never seen before.
Yes, Lee. It's wonderful, really, when we discover that the topography fits perfectly the Exodus record. And there's only one way you can go. This canyon is called the Wadi Wetir. It's a dry riverbed, but it does have water supply. And we found that someone in the past had pushed aside all the big rocks that were naturally in the land and pushed them aside as though a passage of people had to go through here. And interestingly, when you come to the shoreline, it's a huge beach. It's about 7 miles long and as wide as about 3 miles wide. And there's plenty of room there for a nation of people. The Bible said that there were 602,000 men over the age of 20, plus women and children. So if we just multiply that by three, you get around about 2 million people. And there's plenty of room for that on this huge beach. You can see it by satellite. And not only that, there's room enough for an Egyptian army. And Josephus says that they were chased by 250,000 foot soldiers. The book of Exodus said that Pharaoh chose 600 special chariots plus all the chariots of Egypt. And our records from the Egyptian hieroglyphics state that there were little puppet pharaohs that ruling over provinces of Egypt all at the same time, who had as many as 20,000 chariots at their disposal each. So if all the chariots of Egypt were coming, you have tens of thousands of charioteers plus a quarter of a million soldiers, according to Josephus, all chasing after about 2 million people. And there's room for them all on this big beach, and no other place anywhere near the Red Sea is there such room.
Now, they were told to get out of Egypt, and then they left. So why did the Pharaoh and all of these men follow after them? They were told to leave.
Oh, that's a very good question. Yes, in desperation, Pharaoh wanted to get rid of them because his people around him said, "Look, we'll all be dead men if you keep them here." And that's what Exodus tells us, because the plagues came one upon another, and then the death of the firstborn upon Egypt. And so Pharaoh just pushed them out to get rid of them, to stop all the disasters that were coming. But, you know, he had second thoughts about this. Here's a superpower. Egypt stood in relation to other nations in that time, as America stands today in relation to the nations of the world. It was a superpower. Now, you imagine these slaves escaping from Egypt, and the Pharaoh unable to stop them in the eyes of the world. And it must soon have become obvious to him that he'd become the laughingstock of the world if these people escaped. And I guess it was an ego thing. It always is when battles take place. You have to win for your own reputation, and this is what Pharaoh wanted to do.
Didn't they also take a lot of resources, assets with them, gold and that kind of thing?
Oh, yes, and that would be another good reason, too, because the Egyptians just gave away stuff. The Hebrews, before they left, said, "We need this, we need wagons, we need all these things." And they, to get rid of them, they said, "Okay, take them." And really, you know, they'd earned those things. They weren't stealing them. They had worked as slaves for nothing for scores of years. And, okay, now Egypt had lost this. Naturally, the Pharaoh would want to chase after that again and bring them back and punish them.
Okay. Okay, so they're at the water's edge, and then there's an underwater bridge that, of course, it doesn't say anything like that in the scriptures, but that is what you discovered. So
yes,
tell us about
true.
That.
Yes, most certainly. Well, now, the Gulf of Aqaba is like an underwater... If you had took away the sea, you'd have a huge canyon going down about 5,000 feet. So it's very, very deep, just as the Bible says, the deep sea, the heart of the sea. Now, interestingly, through this canyon, it appears a lot of earth and the soil had been washed out into the Gulf of Aqaba at some time earlier. And I would look at that time as being the time of Noah's flood, the great global flood in which the seas all ran back into the hollows as the earth moved and heaved. The book of Psalms describes how that happened, actually, very interestingly, very scientifically. And so water took out a lot of soil and a lot of dirt and debris and pushed it in across that canyon from the west. The same thing happened as the water was running off the land on the eastern side. There's another canyon on the other side, and another big beach, by the way, too. And from these two beaches, east and west, there poured streams and streams, millions of tons of debris, and they met in the middle. And this provided a bridge. Now, as you go down, if you took away all the water and you were on that shoreline, on the Egyptian side, you'd have a something like a 25-degree drop, 45-degree drop all the way down into the bottom of the canyon from the shore. Now, where this bridge is between these two canyons, the change of altitude is actually very, very small. It's only a 7-degree drop down to the center of the land bridge. So this would be very easy for chariots and carts and horses and people to negotiate. Just a 7-degree slope and then back up 7 degrees on the other side again, about 13 miles away on the other side.
Okay. Now, in the video...
Israeli mapping has shown it on their own maps.
Right. Well, you have this wonderful map. You have these wonderful illustrations in the video. We do have a 3-minute break. We will be right back with our guest today, Jonathan Gray. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Jonathan Gray, the author of Forbidden Secret and Dead Men's Secrets. His website is BeforeUs.com, fascinating website. Please go there and also watch this 5-part video, and there are other videos that are available. So we're here at this land bridge, and we have all of these Hebrews. The Israelites are there, and they've got a lot of people behind them that are following close on their trail.
Oh, yes, very frightening. It seems we've climbed some of the mountains along the canyon area, and it appears that the Egyptians did have an occupying force throughout what today we call the Sinai, and they had lookout posts, and they used to use mirrors and flash messages from hilltop to hilltop, which could get back to Pharaoh and his intelligence very, very quickly. And no doubt, something like a Morse code we have in use in our day, they were able to flash messages saying, the Hebrews are here, they're here. Now, the Hebrews had actually asked permission to go out and worship and sacrifice 3 days' journey. But now we find them detouring off the main route through this canyon, which was not in Pharaoh's mind to let them do, and so immediately he's had a change of thought. His men are saying, hey, we can't suffer this indignity to our nation. Let's go after them. So they do. And the Hebrews are caught between, as you might say, the devil and the deep blue sea, Diana. And so Moses calls upon God, and the Lord intervenes. He says, Moses, put your rod out toward the sea. I'm going to send a strong east wind and open up the sea for you. And that happened. His early in the night, the wind began to blow, and it separated the sea into two walls, one on the north, one on each side, actually, right and left, one on the north, one on the south. And there, as the night went on, they started decamping. Now, the Pharaoh's host had camped that night at the back of the beach where they came through the canyon, and a cloud had come in through between them, and the book of Exodus says that the Lord himself gave light from that cloud and darkness to the Egyptians, light to the Hebrews, and so the Hebrews were able to pack up camp, and they started traveling during the night across this open space. And in the morning, Pharaoh's host had been comfortably sleeping, think, well, we've got them anyway, so in the morning we'll round them up. Wake up, they see that they've gone, the cloud has lifted, and they see this whole host of people way over there in the distance crossing over. So they put on their armor, Pharaoh leads them in, and away they go after these people. Very dramatic. And the height of those waves, we didn't realize, Deanna, just how big a job this would be for the wind to open up the sea and hold it there for the Israelites to come through. But it's skyscraper height. The waves on both sides, even though you've only got a 7% drop, slope down and then up again, in the middle, it would be a skyscraper height. As tall as the Empire State Building in New York, you'd have the water in the center piled up on both sides. And when we started diving, suddenly a logistic problem arose in our minds. How on earth could you have the wind blowing and then holding up that water? It would have to be like a mega hurricane. We don't see these things happening in our day. I mean, this is a once-only spectacular event. Wouldn't such a wind have blown the Hebrews away? That was our problem.
Indeed.
So, yeah.
And then you saw a word in the Scripture, congealed, and you were
visited.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes.
So, well, I was traveling home on the plane from the Middle East back to Australia, and where I was living at the time. And I was tossing this over in my mind. How on earth? You know, I read the story of the event in chapter 14 of Exodus and kept on rereading it. Not a clue was given there at all. And then I had a strong impression, keep reading after the event. And there we have on the other end of the crossing, we have Moses, sister Miriam leading the crowd in a great song of triumph and victory and gratitude. And in that song comes the clue as to what had happened. And it's mentioned that the waters congealed. Now, if I like to use the illustration of blood, it's easy to understand. If blood congeals, we get a clot. Is that right?
Right.
And if water congeals, well, I looked up the dictionary. Congeal means a liquid state becomes a solid state. How does liquid water become solid? It can only become solid by turning to ice. So
right.
Suddenly everything fell into place. It began to make sense. Those waters froze. They had to be. The cliffs of water on both sides had to become ice so that the wind could drop. Because if the wind kept on blowing, holding them up, it would just blow the people away. They would never get across.
Right.
So now it made sense.
Okay. We do have a quick three-minute break. We will be right back. And there's incidences of this happening today in certain areas. So we'll talk about that when we come back. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Jonathan Gray. His website is beforeus.com. There are some people in the chat room who are asking questions. And we'll address the relevant ones first. One comment was, no wind has the power to do that. Possibly an electrical phenomenon could. However, there are indications that these battles never occurred on Earth, but were descriptions of battles happening in the sky between electrically active planets. Is that relevant, or can you address that? Or
I would say that we're dealing here with speculation rather than fact. Our archaeological teams have actually unearthed fact, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. The Bible says that God did it. And now, if we do believe in a God, a creator who can make heaven and earth, we should have no trouble in believing that when the Bible says with the breath of his mouth, he actually produced this amazing wind and it opened up the sea, one side and another. There's no known electrical force that could be so precise as to open up that particular spot where the land bridge was on both sides, and hold it there and freeze it so that the people could come through. Now, the Bible word congeal, taking the Bible as an authority, which I do now because we have every reason to accept it word for word as historically true, when it says that the water congealed, it comes from the Hebrew word korphor, which means to shrink or to freeze the water, to change from a fluid or soft to a solid or rigid state. And there's evidence for that having taken place, and we do know that there's backup physical features which can produce the same thing. Now, in a certain part of the hot Iranian desert, and I was travelling through on my way back to the Red Sea, I stopped over at Athens and I had lunch at a certain cafe, and I met a gentleman who was just coming in from Iran. We were sort of comparing notes as to what we were doing, and he said, you know, in a certain part of the hot Iranian desert, villagers have built parallel stone walls close together through which the wind will blow. And then toward night, as the temperature drops, they pour water on the ground between the walls. And he said, I was a witness to this. The night wind freezes the water and provides natural refrigeration. Now, I was in an audience in the United States, speaking in California, and a man came up to me and he said, look, here in the USA, along Arizona Interstate 40, south of Flagstaff, there are road signs that point to ice caves. Now, here, where water has seeped down a mountain into a natural tunnel and the wind blows through in this hot desert country, the water is turned to ice. And he said the pioneers used these ice caves to refrigerate food. I spoke to another man who just come back from the Antarctic, and he said, look, down in the Antarctic, when the wind blows, you can throw a cup of hot coffee into the air, and before it touches the ground, it comes down as icicles. That's the power of wind.
Oh, my.
So all we need to do is use nature, the effect of water or wind blowing on water, to indicate a law of nature in action. But of course, at the Red Sea crossing, this was done on a supernatural scale. And the Bible says a strong wind blowing on walls of water froze them solid. Now, I believe that this is nothing less than a miracle, but it does bring into focus the laws of nature that are already created. And, of course, the Lord is in control of the forces he created, no question.
Right. Now, you said, I believe I heard you say, or I read at some point, that you did not necessarily believe in the Bible before you started this archaeological efforts.
Oh, I lived the life of an unbeliever for decades, a good part of my life. All I was interested in was making money and having a good time, all-night parties and all those sort of things. I had to have that all taken away from me before I'd start thinking about God. Then I'd go into a home of some people, and they turned out to be Christians after they had invited me to lunch, and they'd start playing Christian music during the meal, and I'd be squirming. I just couldn't wait to finish the meal and get out of that house. That's how I used to live.
And you believed in the Big Bang Theory at that point in time, or how did you think that all this came together?
Oh, yes, for a time I did believe in the Big Bang Theory. Of course, we now know that evolution is just a theory. It's not a scientific fact, and there's a lot of scientific evidence now showing something different.
Sure. Okay, so tell us what you found, what the divers found, and you spent a good deal of time going under the water, deep under the water, and what did your crew find? And you had a very nice boat. I mean, you had all of the right equipment. So tell us your findings.
Okay. Well, the findings are absolutely amazing. Now, the passage of time has enabled coral to grow over objects. Coral grows over something and preserves what's inside very, very nicely. Within just half an hour of diving, our first team, we've been down there. We've had up to 35 international divers in all. We've been down there so many times, and each time we go, the sea bed is moving a little bit around. Not the sea bed, the water's moving around, and it covers over things sometimes with sand, and then it uncovers things you didn't see last time. And we're always seeing new things. We're seeing the remains of chariot wheels. There are six-spoked wheels, four-spoked wheels, eight-spoked wheels. There are remains of skeletal remains of humans and of horses, all mixed up around between these wheels. There are parts of cabs of chariots that are separated from the wheels. And that's interesting because the Book of Exodus does say that the chariot wheels all came off when Pharaoh went down, and I believe this is how it must have happened. As the Israelites went through, the wind held off because it had already formed the frozen walls, and this gave them a passageway, and the congealed water between the grains of sand on the seabed would form a hard surface so that their carts and their chariots could come across without any problem. But after a few hours of that, we've calculated that it would have taken about 7 hours for all those people from the first to the last to negotiate the whole distance. And that gives them plenty of time. It could have been quicker than that, but 7 hours at the maximum. Okay, then in the morning, remember 7 hours the wind's not been blowing, all right? A thawing process will begin. And as Pharaoh's army comes down onto the seabed, they stretch out, they're going fast with their chariots. Suddenly, the solid floor is starting to thaw out. What was ice holding the sand together is now becoming wet. It's becoming liquid again. And so the wheels are, the axles are breaking, the wheels are coming off. And this is how we've found it all over the seabed. Wheels that have come off their axles. Axles that have no wheels. Chariot cabs that have no wheels. It's everywhere, Diana. It's amazing, absolutely astonishing.
Right, and you took one of these wheels to an analyst. I don't know whether it was a six-spoke or eight-spoke that you took to an analyst to see exactly what period of time this might have been from.
Yes, my colleague Ron, he went across to Ali Hassan, Dr. Ali Hassan, in the Antiquities Department in Cairo. And he said to him, I've got this off the seabed. Tell me, how can you date this? And you know, that man, without any hesitation, was able to say 18th Dynasty Egyptian. Now, 18th Dynasty Egyptian is in the 1400s BC, the time of Moses. Now, Ron said to him, how can you be sure? So, I mean, you've just told me off the top of your head, you haven't gone researching it, you just looked at the wheel, you've told me this, how do you know so certainly? He said, well, that was the only time in Egyptian history, the 18th dynasty was the only time in Egyptian history when the eight-spoke wheel was used. So that dates it remarkably well. And also there were six-spoke and four-spoke wheels used at the same time, but the eight-spoke was peculiar to that period of history, the time of the Exodus.
Right. And you also found some wheels that were gold or gold-plated over wood.
One that's gold-plated because coral will not grow over gold. It'll grow over iron and wood and other things, but it won't grow over gold. So that wheel has been photographed and re-photographed, and then it gets buried, and we don't see it. If we got one time we'll go down, we won't find it, but it's there.
Now, you mentioned that the sand shift, and pretty soon things get covered up, and I know that when I was in Israel, the Israeli state, there were some aqueducts. And the sand, we have no idea how much the sand moves in the Middle East. But when you consider that these tall aqueducts, some of them were nearly covered over because you have all this flat land, and when the sands blow, they blow in tons of sand that can cover things up. And I would imagine that this occurs at the bottom of the sea also.
Oh, yes, that's right. And if it wasn't for the sand, we'd probably see a lot more there. We have a friend, she's a loose member of the team from Norway. She's a nurse, and she went down. She wanted to go and see if this continued across to the other side. But we've only been diving on the Egyptian end of the crossing. So she managed to get a job as a nurse in Saudi Arabia, and it's very hard to get into that country. They don't open it to tourism the way that we do. And you do. And so if you have an invitation to work there, you have certain skills that they need, then you can get a job often in Saudi Arabia. And on her time off, she made a trip up to the other side of the crossing in Saudi Arabia. And she went diving right there. And the same things we'd been finding on the west, she found on the east end of the crossing. So we know that it goes right across.
And that's, how many miles is that? 26 or 30?
About 13 miles from end to end, yes.
Okay. All righty. There is another question from the chat room. This is from Rick. He says, can you ask your guest if he is aware of Peter Mungo Jupp, J-U-P-P? He is an Australian archaeologist with a passion not to follow traditions in archaeology. Peter does not think archaeology involves being thrilled by dusting off broken pots and bones. What drives him is a passion to ask questions about civilizations and huge constructions that were suddenly smashed and just disappeared from the face of the earth. He also questions how cosmic interference affected our planet.
Yes, I have heard of him, and he's found out some wonderful things. His work and mine touch each other in some ways, but they're not necessarily parallel.
Okay. Now you talk about the big monuments, the big pyramids, and you show what size they are relative to a person that's standing next to a pyramid. And I've often wondered I know they use slave labor, but how did they lift these huge stones and elevate them up so that they could place them one on top of the other? That's always amazed me.
Yes, that's a fascinating question. I know at school we're taught that they got all this huge amount of sand, many times the volume of the pyramids. So take the Great Pyramid, for example. They had sand quite a few times multiplied of volume that the Great Pyramid itself was going to be built of. And so they first built this huge ramp as it went up, and then they used slave labor to pull and haul with ropes and pulleys and so on, to get the big stones up there. Now, it is true that on some of the later monuments of Egypt, that method of construction, which is to us quite primitive, was ultimately used. But in the earlier constructions, it's interesting that the smaller populations of the smaller population times of Egypt in the early days, they built the largest pyramids, the largest construction. Now, they used a different method, and the Egyptian records themselves do say that in the beginning the stones were lifted by sound waves. Now, we might say, well, that sounds a little far-fetched, but it is true today that scientists who are involved with sound waves say that sound waves can help to rearrange the molecular construction of an object so it is lighter and you can lift it up, and this is known to be so because everything is composed of vibrations, and you just change the vibrational rate, and the atomic attraction is changed between atoms in an object, and this could make it lighter for raising. It's interesting also; it's not just Egyptian accounts that speak of sound waves being used to neutralize the effect of gravity. But if you go to South America, there are primitive tribes who point to ruins of buildings in cities that no longer are inhabited, and they say, our ancestors, our forefathers built this city, and they did it with sound waves. They raised these big blocks by sound. If you go to the Caroline Islands in the Pacific, similar legends still exist. You go to India, and in modern times, sound waves, a certain pitch, chanting and sound has been used to raise a huge block of stone up a cliff. This is documented in our day. So it would not be surprising to think that the Egyptians did have the secret of lifting heavy weights without having to use slave labor and pulleys and huge amount of sand.
Well, that is interesting. Would you relate that to directed energy?
You could relate that to directed energy, yes. There are people working now with car engines who say that sound can increase the fuel consumption of a vehicle, but it's not in general use right now. But experimentally, it has been done.
Amazing. All righty, we're going to take a 3-minute break to hear a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Jonathan Gray, the author of Forbidden Secret and Dead Men's Secrets. His website is beforeus.com. And one of the questions in the chat room, what time period do you date the Giza pyramids to?
Okay, that's an interesting one. I know traditionally the Great Pyramids dated around about 2800 BC. I do believe that it was more recent than that by several hundred years. If we look at Egyptian history, we find that it has been inflated. And pharaohs who ruled simultaneously in different parts of Egypt have been mistaken as pharaohs reigning consecutively, and therefore they've been placed on the Egyptian king list as later or earlier, which extends the period. And this is an artificial inflation. Now, also, many pharaohs had as many as five names, and sometimes these five names were used and others were not of the same person. And these have been put into the king list as though they were five different people. Now, when we discover this and we start putting everything how it should be, it diminishes history in Egypt by about 600 years. And so what is said to be have happened about 2800 BC, it comes down to about 2200 BC. And there's evidence that the Great Pyramid, certain factors about that pyramid that enable us to date it as having been constructed between 2100 BC and 2200 BC.
All righty. Another comment. I believe this is from Rick. He said that there is a well-known water bridge which can be formed by applying high voltage to two different containers of water. Are you familiar with that kind of situation?
I'm not confused about how that could form a bridge, but that's an interesting idea. I'd need more information on that to speak on it.
Okay. Now, in your book, Forbidden Secret, part two, you ask the question, did aliens create us?
Oh, yes. It's a popular question today. There are, you know, for a long, long time, we've been taught the theory of evolution, and it's still taught in places of learning today. And yet, when Darwin postulated his theory of the origin of species back in 1859, he published his book, certain features of the of science were not discovered. DNA and genetics, of course, was one, and fossils had not been explored as they have now. And today, the new evidence is showing the evolution theory is looking rather sick. So there are people who are looking for another answer to the origin of human life on this planet, and they're turning toward the possibility that extraterrestrials visited this Earth, and either they created life, or they interbred or produced genetic combinations with what they had and Earth life that was trying to evolve but wasn't doing very well. And that's a theory. Now,
all righty. We have our 60-second top of the hour break, so we'll be right back after station ID and a word from our sponsors. Be right back. Welcome back. Second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. Our guest today is Jonathan Gray. He is the author of Forbidden Secret and Dead Men's Secrets. His website is beforeus.com. And I also have a link to today's date, a very nice five-part video series called Surprising Discoveries and The Sea Will Tell. And be sure to watch that those five parts. And we were talking about a particular chapter in your book called Did Aliens Create Us?
Yes, well, this is an interesting theory, Deanna, and it's attractive to many people. Way, way back in the 1960s and 70s, a man called Eric von Däniken caused a bit of a sensation when he claimed that sophisticated ancient relics were the result of a space visit to Earth. Well, like others, he assumed that early man had struggled for endless millions of years as you might say, a primitive, dumb, and rather stupid creature, unable to accomplish much on his own. Then, quite suddenly, in just the last few thousand years, he nurtures a technology so intricate and so sophisticated that it does suggest intellectual maturity from the start. Now, you don't have to be smart to realize there's something wrong here. So, faced with the new evidence of man's sudden high new technology, it was postulated that maybe visitors from outer space were responsible and that these aliens crossbred with primates to produce modern man, and then modern man suddenly became intelligent. Well, I'd like to say this. If we go by evidence, not one of the out-of-place artifacts from the past is composed of material unknown to Earth, for a start. Their technological makeup conforms with the development of our own modern civilization. And, of course, we must realize that if you're unable to produce modern man by evolution, because it's just too difficult, and now we have the laws of genetics and so on, we have a new problem. The problem of the origin of intelligence is only removed to another planet. You've got to account for civilizations now, not just on this world, but on the world that brought it. And you still have to find out how that first intelligence began. Now, naturally, if evolution cannot account for it on this planet, it is equally impossible to explain a more highly intelligent man evolving on some other planet.
Indeed.
So, I'd say it doesn't help the situation at all.
Right. And certainly with the intricate structure of the human body and the way that it works and functions together in such a symmetrical, in such a way that everything works, the Big Bang theory is preposterous. That would be, like an explosion and having everything land appropriately to be able to function in some systematic order, which is preposterous.
Yes, absolutely preposterous. It'd be like somebody throwing all the pieces up into the air and then they fall down and produce a jet plane.
Right. There is a supreme being, and just because we cannot wrap our minds around it, how he did whatever it was he did, how he created the world and the people on it, the creatures on it, does not mean that because we can't understand it that supreme being does not exist.
No, Deanna, it's like a little ant. I was at a football game a few years ago, and I'll talk about this when we come back.
All right. We'll be right back. Got the music. Be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Jonathan Gray. His website is beforeus.com, and please pick it up from where we left off just before the break.
Okay, Deanna, I was going to relate that one day I was at a football game and I just plopped myself down on the grass to watch the game. And for a brief moment, my eye caught a tiny little ant, and it was battling so heroically through the blades of grass. You know, that little ant moved around beneath the football turf, and the blades of grass were over its head, the soil was under it, and there were tinier life forms, I'm sure, all around. And that was the world the ant understood. Now, As the football game unfolds, this little ant may not, he may see an occasional shadow move above him. He may hear the thud of giant feet and feel the ground shake around him, but he has not the foggiest idea what is going on in that world above him. He crawls around the grass shoots. He's virtually unaware of anything but his own world. Now, could that explain how we might be in relation to God? That we ask about his power, we ask about where he came from, and we try to use our limitations of time and space to measure his existence and what he can do. And if we could really fully understand God, if I could understand God fully, I would either be a God myself, or God would just cease to be God. Just because I live in my reality is no reason to dismiss his reality, any more than an ant could dismiss your reality and mine because it doesn't understand us.
Right. That's a very good analogy. Now, in Genesis, we find the term, the phrase, God created the world in 6 days. I don't believe it's the 6 days that we, like a 24-hour period of time. I believe it was probably six periods of time. What are your feelings on that?
Well, unfortunately, I have to go with the Hebrew.
Okay.
When you have the Hebrew yom with a number, Hebrew scholars everywhere keep telling me that it has to be a 24-hour day. And that, of course, then I have to fight with my ability to understand how God could do it so quickly. But
sure.
I have to go with the language.
Okay. We do have some callers lining up, so why don't we take a call? Let's take Mike in Kentucky. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Hello, Mike.
Hi.
Hello. Okay, I didn't know I'd been added yet or not. There's usually like a little sound or something whenever they turn you on. I think we got kind of, and I've noticed this years and years ago, we got quite a conundrum with what they try to tell us about the nature of our universe and how long it's been here and how long it took life supposedly to evolve. And, you know, I noticed quite a while back that the moon is awfully unique. Our satellite of the Earth is in an odd kind of position. And so, you know, you start to go, wait a minute, you know. And I just went to this, they have an annual look at the moon event at the local observatory they recently put up, which I sort of was in support of it and helped the space science program at the local university. They have a look at the moon event, and they had a lecture from some brilliant Indian exchange student, you know, was giving a little lecture on the size of the universe and all this stuff, and he said that basically the latest thinking is it's something like 35 billion light years across, which is hard to imagine, you know, hard to conceptualize how big that is, but, you know, given that, you know, the supposed Big Bang theory says that it expanded from some infinitesimally small point in the universe, then, you know, half of 35 billion would be, 17.5 billion years old, and they want to tell us that our solar system is less than 5 billion years old, and then it took about a billion years for life to evolve on the Earth from primordial slime. So, I mean, you just do the math there. It's, you know, don't let the number billion scare you. You get the impression that all of the material, all the matter that makes up the Earth was part of some other solar system, probably maybe two or three other solar systems before it became part of our solar system, given the age of the universe. So the idea that we are already developing cloaks of invisibility, you know, we can make an entire troop transport in a tank invisible to the naked eye and to infrared light. What are we going to be capable of doing in 1,000 years if we don't kill ourselves off? We're going to start to appear like gods.
Jonathan, your comment.
Well, yes, you know, we are made in the image of our Creator. We're told that. He has given us the ability. He's given us intelligence. He's given us a feeling for handcrafts and technology, desire to create things. And was it Einstein who says we only use about 10% of our brain, our created brain capacity? There's something there that we're not using that he's given us, and who knows how far we could accomplish things with what he has put into us, given time. Of course, we could have lost the ability that he gave us originally, but the fact is that we're only using 10%, it boggles the mind, we're only using about 10% of our brain capacity at the moment.
I told that to somebody not too long ago, and they said, no, I've read it's 4%. We're only using about 4% of our brain capacity. What our brain does is stores things in multiple locations. The Russians did experiments way back about 35 years ago where they sliced part of people's brains out that were alive, and they spliced them, implanted them somehow into somebody else's brain, and even after that person had died, there were phantom memories, and they recognized people from that other person's memory. And apparently our brain does something sort of like a hologram. It stores things in multiple locations. That's why some people can have massive head trauma and damage from a stroke or something, and they'll recover a lot of their memory because we store things in multiple locations. So, but I don't know if it's 4% or if it's 10%. Obviously, we could probably still live to 1,000 years if we were able to somehow do that and keep ourselves healthy. But they're finding out that a lot of the modern society is really screwing up our brain because there's a gut-mind or brain connection between the friendly bacteria that live in our bowels, and we're constantly being bombarded with the antibiotics and the from the meats that they, you know, these factory raised industrial foods, the plastics as antibiotics, you know, we're drinking chlorinated water, and it's killing off the friendly symbiotic bacteria that lives in our guts, and they make B vitamins and serotonin that helps us be alert and heal our brains. And why is it I talked to an epidemiologist about this last year on Facebook, and he said it's not considered an epidemic unless there's a change in the rate of infection. But if 40% of the world has toxoplasmosis, a latent infection of it, from being exposed to the dust from rat feces or cats or things like the meats, be it sheep or pork, if 40% of the world has toxoplasmosis, how come you can't get tested for it? You know, where's the test that would reveal this? It's because it would cost Big Pharma billions of dollars if they could treat people for toxoplasmosis and get rid of a lot of these chronic illnesses, and they would.
I'm wondering, Mike, if this is really on topic.
Well, I think our minds are being clouded by a lot of junk.
Oh, I'm sure.
I think it's intentional.
Sure.
What you're talking about, the topics of being able to do things with our minds, I think though most of our population is walking around like zombies.
Okay, your thoughts, Jonathan.
Yes, certainly we're degenerate from what we were given in the beginning. And we're responsible, really, ourselves for what we've become. But we do have this. The positive side is that we have a creator who loves us, every single one. He's planning a perfect world with perfect people in it, and he's giving us a promise that if we listen to him and we just follow his instructions,
yeah,
wonderful things will happen to us individually, and we'll have a place in that new kingdom, and we can be, if we make the right decisions now, we can be trusted to be one of those who'll be there.
Well, we're also heavily warned that we will be handed over to a reprobate mind or a useless mind, and I think there's a lot of us we're surrounded by that have been handed over to a reprobate mind. They do not want to explore. I call them militant atheists. You cannot even talk about this kind of stuff with them. They just, you know, they're ready to cuss you out and, you know.
Right, I think there is
a very
anti-religious mentality that likes to wipe this kind of thing out.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike. Now, in your discoveries, in your archaeological finds, you have discovered things that that one wouldn't expect to find, that there were civilizations who had, for instance, they performed intricate surgeries and have done so many other things that we are just now getting around to doing now that were done before. And you found machinery and artifacts, that tools and things. We are going to break, and maybe we can talk about this when we come back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Jonathan Gray. His website is beforeus.com. And could you tell us a little bit about the artifacts that you have found that indicate that we have advanced before and that we seem to be advancing again?
Well, yes, we're it's not. Interesting that I think it was Thomas Edison, after the first telephone calls had been made a statement. He said the old inventions had been reinvented. It's very interesting that he must have had access to old documents and the knowledge of the past that most of the people today don't know anything about. Well, one thing that's always never fails to fascinate me is the discovery way back in 1901. It was on Easter Day. Divers were in a very old shipwreck on the seabed off the coast of Antikythera Island in Greece, and they brought up quite a lot of the stuff, the cargo from this boat that had sunk, and largely statues, and among them was a metal artifact. It had been fused by the sea into a lump, and they didn't know how to clean this off without destroying it, so it just collected dust for 50 years. And then it was restored by acid baths. Now, it absolutely was unbelievable. It was a bronze machine with complex dials and movable pointers and a system of interlocking gears, more than 20 gear wheels, a differential gear, a crown wheel. And you could set a question, you could set all the questions you wanted relating to astronomy and geography, and it would calculate for you not just the motions of the sun and the moon and the planets ahead of time and way back into the past, give their position, but the movement of the tides, where you were on the planet by longitude and latitude, and to use it, you would simply set your question. Now, this is first-class precision mechanics, Deanna. It's as accurate as anything that can be made today. And it was used by ships for navigation. Now, we generally have assumed that a boat could not sail out of sight of land, otherwise it wouldn't know where it was going. Well, this computer was used for checking one's position even at night. And it dates back to the first century, but it's obvious that it's from a much older technology. A Cambridge scientist commented on this, and he said, "Finding this is like finding a jet plane in the tomb of Tutankhamun," and I agree with him.
Right. Now, the Egyptians had quite an advanced society, correct?
Yes, they did, most certainly. Actually, the Egyptians started off with a very high society, which deteriorated over the centuries. So it started at the top, not at the bottom. It didn't evolve upward.
Okay. All righty, let's take another call. Let's take Michael in New York. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Deanna. Hi, Jonathan. Yeah, actually, it wasn't even called Egypt in those ancient times, right, Jonathan? It was called the Land of Chem with a K-H.
That is right.
And that was more than just a mechanical device, actually, sir. It was also a mechanical advanced computer in order to do all those calculations so quickly.
Oh, yes, it was a computer. No question about that. It acted, it did all the things for what a computer would be asked to do.
Yes, sir. I know you worked with Ron Wyatt, and if you get a chance, Jonathan, could you elaborate a bit on the discoveries with Ron Wyatt, in particular, the Mount Sinai, the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah still under sulfur, and then in particular, the Ark of the Covenant, the latest on that since he discovered it there in Jerusalem.
If you got me started on this, I could go for days, Michael, but I'll just try to summarise very quickly. Very fascinating. I went out as a sceptic against Ron Wyatt to start with. I was loaded with my arguments, and yet something bothered me. I thought, well, I've got to be honest about this. I don't know as much as I'd like to know. So I phoned him several times from Australia across to Nashville, Tennessee, where he was, and I eventually ended up flying over there and spending several days. And rather than shooting him down, I found that the evidence was inescapable. So then I decided I would go further than that, and I drew out all the money I had in my bank account, and I ran a series of expeditions with my own scientists, and we went to these various sites, not the Mount Sinai one, but we've got colleagues who have. And we were able to confirm beyond any doubt that this man was telling the truth. As a matter of fact, today in Israel, I just got an email from somebody in Israel, and he's a friend of one of the guides who takes buses down to Masada, which overlooks the ruins of Gomorrah, facing toward the Dead Sea. And a customer asked him, look, have you heard about Sodom and Gomorrah? Is this the ruins? And he said, no. But then he said, he spoke to another tour operator, and he said, yes, these are the ruins, and he gave him the evidence. And so now in Israel, there are tourist guides who are recommending the site, and the government people know it. It's recommended, and it's also recognized. My first night in Gomorrah, I slept on the ashes, and the next day, here I was picking balls of sulfur out of the ashes. The buildings are very clear. One's a five-story building. There are windows. There are doors. They've all been turned to ash. And it's absolutely incredible. That's the ruins of sulfur.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Jonathan Gray. His website is beforeus.com. Continue. You woke up and you were on this wonderful site, and I've been there myself. But
yes. Oh, yes. So, my first visit there, Deanna, I actually looked around for a place to sleep, which wasn't very comfortable to start with, but I saw animal tracks that were crossing over from the desert, and not knowing how wild they might be, I thought, well, I better sleep somewhere where animals are not going to come past me. So I lay down on the ashes behind a big block of stone that had fallen off a building, which was turned to ash, of course. And no sleep. I kept waking up every few minutes, and the stars hardly seemed to move all night. But when the sun came up in the day, it was so blazing hot. You cannot stay, in the summertime, you cannot stay out there in that sun more than about 30 minutes. You must take a lot of water. You must take eyeglasses, take shaded glasses, keep a hat over your head and over your neck. People have died in that desert within hours, not days, but hours in that desert without water. It used to be a beautiful, lush area, like the Garden of Eden, so the Book of Genesis says. The whole thing now rests under a very definite curse, you could call it. The countryside now is just plain desert and ash. But at first, when I realized that this was what it was, I wanted some evidence that would convince the skeptical world. And I did not get that evidence until the next trip. And I prayed for 2 weeks before leaving home that some kind of evidence would be there that I could convince the world with. Well, the next time we arrived, I arrived with a guy with a television camera and several others, and we pulled in about 9 o'clock at night, and I jumped out of the four-wheel vehicle, and there, my wife pulled out beside me. This was her first trip. She shone the torch between my feet, and there was a sulfur ball. It had just fallen out of a hole somewhere. And one of the men got a box of matches. We got a spoon. We put the sulfur ball on the spoon. We lit it. It started to burn, so we knew it was sulfur. And it smelled like sulfur. It was sulfur. And that gave us electricity, you might say. It gave us light for the evening while we laid down our sleeping gear and so on. And the next day, we just picked up these everywhere. There are millions of them. And, of course, that's exactly what the Bible says. God rained down fire and brimstone. Brimstone, the dictionary says, is sulfur. Mm-hmm. Balls of sulfur. And there's the evidence.
Okay. All righty. Let's see. What else did Michael ask?
The Ark of the Covenant.
Okay. The Ark of the Covenant.
The Ark of the Covenant is the subject of a 600-page book I've written detailing our confirmation as a separate team. It went in, been in several times later, not underground. Well, yes, we have gone underground, but not into the cave itself. Just before he died, Ron Wyatt was planning to take me in there so that I would sight it with my own eyes. We do know that while I was in Jerusalem, six Israelis sent in by the Israeli government toward the cave vanished, and a probing discovered their six bodies 70 feet along the tunnel toward the Ark of the Covenant cave. They had each one suffered a bilateral stroke. Both eyes were of their eyes, the six men, they'd been dressed as Levitical priests. The Antiquities Department had tried to move the Ark to a safer place, which they thought would be out of the Arab area, where it is, underground, 20 feet below the streets, into an Israeli area that they keep their eye on, and the six men died. There'd been a lot of supernatural events associated with this. Dr. Dan Behart of the Antiquities Department, who gave Ron his permit to dig there, when he was given an item out of that cave, he asked for something out of the cave that would prove the Ark was in there. Ron brought this out. It was a high priest, part of the high priest scepter that was put in there at the same time when it was secreted. All the things out of the first temple were put there and they're still there. It's now in the Israeli Museum. That convinced Dr. Behart that the find had been made. He made several steps toward the excavation tunnel, and he collapsed on the ground and was paralyzed for 2 weeks. At the end of that, he stated, "I'm never again going to try to access the Holy Ark." So there are supernatural events taking place in Israel which indicate that there's something supernatural going on there and that the claims that Ron has found the Ark have substance to them.
Okay. What other thing did you ask, Michael?
Yes, Deanna, thank you. Well, that was pretty much it on the Ron Wyatt discoveries, and it's very interesting, Jonathan. You know, it may very well be that the device is still active, the Covenant, and truly only the ultimate purists are able to approach it or even handle it. Anything with any form of... Yes, sir.
It would seem that this is not an ordinary artifact, for sure. There's a divine presence here and a divine control.
It is amazing, and unfortunately, no one's aware of this because the public, the mainstream media is keeping it from the public. And real quick, with regarding to lifting the stones through sound vibrations, how about the example of that in that photo from Andrew Thomas's book, We Were Not the First? We're in India, a group of men in a circle with their, I believe, their index fingers all on this large stone, chanting this particular sound. And the stone is obviously levitating at least 5-6 feet in the air, if I recall right.
That's correct, yes. That was the example. That's not the same example I was mentioning from India, but it parallels it.
Yes, sir. Obviously a real science.
It's a science that we haven't gone into too much in our day, but there are a few scientists who are experimenting right now. As I mentioned, with motor fuel and motor engines, they can increase the performance by sound waves.
Yes, sir, and lift heavy objects as well. Thank you, Deanna. Thank you, Jonathan. Keep up the great work. God bless now.
Thank you. All right, let's take Larry in Washington. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna. And a question for the gentleman. I was reading something from a Dr. Shalom Sand. He's a professor at Tel Aviv University.
Right.
And did you ever hear what he had to say about Jewishness? I mean, he wrote a book, When and How Was the Jewish People Invented? And in the book, he says that he cannot find any evidence of the empire of David or Solomon, and he can't find any evidence of the exile.
Okay, yes, your thoughts, Jonathan.
Yes, I am totally familiar with that theory, and I understand where he is coming from. However, I have put out an e-book called King Solomon's Riches, Putting Together the Pieces, in which I deal with his particular arguments. Now, the arguments are based upon a wrong dating of Israeli history. And you just change the dates, everything comes together perfectly. And the evidence that there was an Empire of Solomon in the 10th century B.C. is absolutely incredible. The evidence is amazing. Remember how Egyptian chronology is 600 years an era, 600 mm-hmm. years too long? So the Israeli coordination with other nations has been misplaced. There are exaggerated time periods, but when you put the right time settings in, the evidence of a huge empire is there. The evidence for the Israeli exodus is found on the Egyptian monuments and also in letters that were written to kings in Canaan and from kings in Canaan. We have evidence that King David ruled, that he was followed by King Solomon. That evidence is startling, but it'd probably take too long to give it to you. If you want to email me, go to my website, find my email address there, give me an email, and I'll send it to you free, a full report, about a 30-page report. It's a 70-page report.
When I was reading this, I've looked at so many different variances of Christianity that, you know, the Jews aren't the Jews, this and that, and I'm reading this, and I'm starting to say, well, wait a minute, why even believe in the damn Bible anymore? I mean, you can't even get the Jews to agree that there was ever kingdoms.
There are two types of Jews today, my friend, as you know. There are those who follow the Bible and there are those who don't.
The Torah now, and the Talmudic Jews.
Yes, that is correct. Now, those who don't have the same attitude as atheists do who are not Jews. I was run by an atheist. Let me tell you this. After I put out my book, The Forbidden Secret, I got a phone call from Australia. I'm in New Zealand now. And a gentleman rang, he said, I am the president of the Atheist Foundation of Australia. He said, I'm very upset about this new book you put out. He said, some of my people are reading it. I said, well, that's good. Have you read it? He said, no, it's a lot of nonsense. I'm not going to read it. Now, that's the kind of attitude when evidence is presented and available that people will make their statements and they will try to influence others, and yet they themselves admit they are not looking at the evidence. So I think we've got to be honest with evidence. Evidence is something you can hold, you can feel it, you can see it, you can smell it sometimes. And unfortunately, there are Jewish people who will not look at the evidence. And that's the best I can say about that. But the evidence is there. I've published it, I've put it out, and I know many others have as well.
Sir, I appreciate that answer very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome.
All righty, let's take Pat in England. Pat, welcome to the program.
Yes, sure. Hello, Deanna. Great to be on your show again. Some time now, and obviously to speak to your guest. I really just want to ask, and please forgive me if you've spoken about this artifact already, because I joined the show a little bit later. Is your guest, Jonathan, are you aware of all about the work of David Davidson in the 1940s and the ongoing writings of people like Raymond Capps and so on and so forth, all about the Great Pyramid of Giza and how, despite the fact that it's been usurped by the Freemasons and things like that, however, in its original concept, it is an absolute mathematical work of art attributed to Enoch and apparently typified in Isaiah 19 as the witness in stone, and its internal measurements of the passage measurements using the pyramid inch, you know, of the ascending passage, the great gallery, king's chamber with its empty coffer, correspond in time chronology to things like the detail concerning the gospel message of Jesus Christ and Israelite and Anglo-Saxon history. And it seems that builders knew all about the astronomy, its location, Pythagoras' theory, and it goes on and on and on. It is absolutely phenomenal, the Great Pyramid. And, of course, you understand it a bit more if you also believe and understand, this is interesting for your previous caller, that the Old Testament can really only really be totally understood when you actually look at the scriptural prophecies and see that they've actually been fulfilled, the promise to Abraham, in the United States of America and the British Empire, the multitude of nations promised, you know, to the leading tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, and that they were lost to the world, but known to God, to carry on, you know, being fulfilled in the unconditional covenants and the numerous scriptural prophecies. So that's it, really. Over to you. Thank you.
Well, yes, certainly the Great Pyramid is a masterpiece of scientific precision. We do not possess any machine today capable of making equally smooth surfaces as those connecting the stones of the pyramids. They were fitted together with an accuracy of 1/100th of an inch. Now, the measurements in its design are absolutely amazing too, and you can get the length of the year, the distance from the Great Pyramid to the equator, the distance from the Earth to the Sun. There are so many scientific principles incorporated into the measurements of the Great Pyramid, and our own discoveries today prove it to be absolutely correct. Not only that, it's almost indestructible. I recall reading about something that happened about 1200 AD, where a man, an Arab man, employed thousands of workers to pull down the three Giza pyramids stone by stone. And they went at the smallest pyramid for 8 exhausting months, and then he gave the order to suspend all work when he realized that the building had scarcely been touched. And these pyramids are as strong today as when they were built. And scientists have conceded that modern man cannot build a pyramid that would retain its shape for thousands of years without sagging under its own weight. So that's just the start of it. There's so much about this. Davidson, I'm familiar with his work. He was an engineer for, I think, the city of Manchester in England for many, many years, and then he went down to Egypt and he did enormous research, and I respect his work.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he identified things like the displacement factor, which apparently was deliberately put into the workings and the measurements of the pyramid so that the capstone would not fit. And then people today believe that that is there deliberately to typify a type of Christ. It was the stone that the builders rejected from the Book of Acts. And there's so much more that you can talk about, and it is a mathematical work of art, and you can go in it, and people, yeah, it was only discovered, wasn't it, back in the 40s or before. People, there was a false entry, wasn't it? The Arab tried to get inside it, and apparently it's casing stones. Apparently, they reckon could be seen from the moon. They were just so perfect. But that's all, really. It's just amazing. It's just such a mathematical work of art, and it's worth looking at and spending time on. And there is a prophecy in the Book of Isaiah which seems to potentially specify that work of art. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. All right, let's quickly take Ken in Virginia. Ken, we're about to go to break, but come on and introduce yourself, ask your question.
Yeah, I want to change the subject, if I may. This has to do with Andrew Jackson, I want to.
You know, this is we've got to remain on topic.
All right. I'll have to try another time. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Ken. All righty. We're going to break. We'll be right back and take Charles. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today has been Jonathan Gray. He is the author of Forbidden Secret and Dead Men's Secrets and other books. His website is beforeus.com. And would you agree that corporate churches have co-opted religion in order to make money?
Oh, yes. Many of them have. And we see good evidence of that on some of the television shows that have been going for years. And the results of where the money's gone to. It's sad to say, but that's unfortunate and gives a bad name to true Christianity.
Sure. All right, let's take Charles in San Jose. Charles, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Can you hear me? Oh, yes. I was calling to ask, I know Deanna knows this already, but I wanted to ask if Jonathan knew that the white people are the actual Israelites who founded all the nations as prophesied.
Well, we do know that Israelite migrations took place after the Israelites were taken by the Assyrians, and migration into Europe has taken place and into the Western world, yes.
And that the Jews in their own writings say that they are not the Israelites of the Bible.
You're talking about two types of Jews here, those who come from the tribe of Judah and those who are the pretenders who've set up certain organizations.
The term Jew was probably first coined in about 1830, sometime after the Rothschilds took control of the printing houses and first used that term in print, I think in 1830 in the Webster's Dictionary.
Yes, I know the history of what you're saying. Maybe I shouldn't say this on air, but there's a religious Christian organization who is pulling the strings behind all that.
Which one?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't understand that. A religious organization?
Yes. The Jews today are the front men for an agenda that's been going on for several hundred years.
Oh,
maybe
yes.
Maybe this is not the place and time to say it, but a religious organization founded in one of the famous cities of Europe is pulling the strings behind it.
I used to work in a synagogue counseling, and I asked the rabbis one time why there were no Bibles there, and they basically told me that they don't worship God, that they worship that they worship Lucifer, and the Talmud actually states that.
Right.
But the white people are the actual Israelites, according to all the facts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you so much, Charles. We're running out of time. One more question. What about the Scofield Bible?
The Scofield Bible, I would not put my trust in it, unfortunately. It would take probably 10 minutes to trace the history of it, but it's suspect, unfortunately.
Okay, well, we're going to have to do this again, because you've just covered just a little tiny bit of what we could be talking about here. So I hope that you will join me again.
It'd be my pleasure, Deanna, and thank you so much for having me on. I've certainly enjoyed being with you today.
Well, thank you so much. It has been wonderful. And again, your website is beforeus.com, and people can purchase your books there. They can purchase them on Amazon. And thank you so much. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow.